Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast whose will is not weak. How dare... Oh, will. Sorry. Okay. I'm Brendan.
Ah, je m'appelle Nathan Estram.
And the Doctor is our loyal demon. Gung, gully, gully, gung, 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 gung. I don't know the words to this song.
Gung, gully, gully, gung, 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 gung.
I hope you all will hum along.
Gung, gully, gully, gung, 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 gung.
It's the King's Demons.
I'm so sorry, everybody. That's what I remember from this story as a kid. My sisters and I didn't know the lyrics to that, but we just remembered the Doctor is our Lord Demon, and like we're so not musically inclined in my family, so it was like this, that's the strumming of the whatever they play.
I was singing this really quite loudly around the house this morning, and I do know the words, and then I realised that they were really kind of insulting to my Muslim neighbours, so I stopped.
Yeah, against the Saracen who we abhor.
Yeah, no, yeah. Terrible.
Also, yeah, it's great good. That Terence Dudley is back with racism. Didn't he write Black Orchid?
Yeah,
so that was a lot of horrible people doing to somebody who's been incapacitated in some way.
Yeah, so it was ableism last time. At least this time, the racism is historically accurate.
Yeah, there's not really that much of it.
Yeah. Terence Dudley is back, or T Duds, as I've taken to calling him, for his final script for the program.
Hooray!
Oh, God.
And you discovered this week, I think, Brendan, that his first script for the program could have been...
Oh, my God. I've subscribed to Doctor Who The Complete History, which is like getting two Peter Haining books in your post once a month. Roughly 128 to 176-page book covers between two and four Doctor Who stories. So the first book covers An Unearthly Child or the Daleks, or because this is from the makers of Doctor Who magazine, it covers 100,000 BC and the mutants, a.k.a. the Daleks.
They're monsters, aren't they?
They do at least include a full-page discussion as to why these are the correct titles.
No.
But they've got, of course, a very lengthy origin section of Doctor Who. So obviously Verity Lambert did go on record as saying, look, if we'd had another script, we wouldn't have started with cavemen. Not that it was bad or anything, but it just wasn't showing what we wanted to do with the show. At one point, they did actually try to ditch that script and just keep Anthony Coburn's unmade script, Doctor Who and the Robots, later made by Big Finish's Masters of Luxor. And they approached Terence Dudley to write the first Doctor Who story. And he declined.
And aren't we all grateful?
Yeah, because, that's why we're here.
Because I think if anything is obvious after Terence Dudley's three scripts for the program and also directing Meg Loss, he has no interest in science fiction.
No. You can tell from that second series of Survivors, which I think he has a big hand in, where they all just sort of settle down and grow cabbages and nothing really very interesting happens. So... you know, he's not very good. None of his scripts are very good, and this is no exception. It's really terrible.
You know, this is mine, apparently.
Right.
But I just can't remember anything about it without looking at my notes. And even then, that's not quite true. I can remember some things. There's some of the lines, like when I really like, is it Gerald Flood as the king? I love it, like our champion, our demon. Like, those are things that actually stick with me. And I think he actually does a great performance.
Yeah.
Possibly the highlight of this whole thing. And then he's got his champion who talks about the blue engine. I love that line, the blue engine. A friend of Nathan and mine used to have a blue engine car.
That's right. His car was called the Blue Engine.
Glenn Langford, former Doctor Who fan.
he got better.
those little things. I like those little... those little lines. But honestly, the friggin' master, I was watching one of the documentaries in a future story, and it mentions that Anthony Ainley had a contract to appear in two Doctor Who stories a year up until 1984. Now, I don't know who he had it over, right? But it was contracted that he would be paid for two appearances, even if he did not appear. So we had... Keeper of Traken and Logopolis, Castro Valva and Time Flight. And so this year it's The King's Demons and The Five Doctors.
Yeah. Mm.
And then his contract runs out with Planet of Fire. That's, you know, they don't get the two in. But he still gets paid.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely.
He must have had photos of someone.
And, I'm pretty sure in a few years' time he gets paid for the unmade season 23 as
he
well.
He does because he
had a new contract.
He had a new contract where he was then for 3 years at least one story a year.
Yeah.
So he got paid for that. Colin got paid for that season as
so
well.
So did Nicola. Yeah.
So did Nicola. So it's like, whatever. But, we have to use the master.
I'm a bit conflicted about him in this one because Sir Gilles is just unforgivable.
Terrible but, French accent, much worse than mine was just now. Like really, really bad.
Like yeah, comically bad.
Yeah.
But once he reveals himself, I quite like Anthony Ainley in this story. Like when he takes his TARDIS down to the dungeon and he's ingratiating himself with Lady Isabel, I think he's actually quite charming in that scene. There's a touch of Delgado with Ingrid Pitt.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, we've got Ilsa Blair, who was Cinefar in Blake 7 Duel.
It was totally bugging me. I knew that I knew her from somewhere.
And, she's one of those people who she was regularly doing TV guest appearances. She's still acting now. She has this quietness about her performance, but with the quietness, she has that wonderful Shakespearean quality, which a lot of stage actors have, where no matter how quiet they are, you are still listening to them, like Judi Dench or Derek Jacobi. I don't think she ever raises her voice in this story, except maybe when Sir Geoffrey's killed. But all the time, whenever she's talking, you're not listening to anyone else. You've got Frank Windsor as her husband. He's very good. He'll come back in Ghost Light.
Yeah.
You've got Christopher Villiers, I think, as her son. And this was very early on in his career, and he went on to be quite successful.
He's cast really for one reason, isn't
he? He's quite hot.
He's really pretty.
Hello.
But he seems to have found some peroxide that's fallen backwards yes. through a crack in time, because he does have lovely blonded hair, doesn't he? Much like Pete, I guess.
He actually agreed not to cut his hair in the lead up to this. It was written into his contract, whereas all the other blokes had hair pieces.
Right.
Except for Gerald Flood.
It's quite interesting. Like, the one thing I do like the fact is that the Master does manipulate these people against the Doctor, in that episode, and I find it quite frustrating. But I like that as a view of the fact that, he's manipulating them and
do you remember the first time you watched it, whether you recognised that Sir Gilles was the Master?
That's the question I was going to ask you, so you beat me to it. I think I did. Initially, because he doesn't speak, I kind of went, do I know you?
Mm-mm.
Then when he started to speak his... a blue engine. I worked out that I'm pretty sure I worked out before the reveal. It was like fairly obvious. I think that's what I do remember.
Yeah, it's not like the Portrieve or Khalid where you can imagine on first broadcast you might have been fooled. I mean, the thing is, coming to those stories, I always knew.
Yeah,
Khalid, like for God's sake, you'd never know. No,
yeah, exactly. And the Portrieve, he's really good and his whispery voice. But it's mainly the voice that gives him away. I think the beard is stupid.
Yeah,
but it does effectively disguise his face.
I think there are a few shots where it is really, really visibly Ainley in a way that you could probably have picked up at home.
Mm. But, he's trying to disguise his voice again with this really atrocious accent.
Yeah.
Like, he is trying to do something, to try and make it.
He's still no Professor Thescalis, though, is he?
But at the same time, even Roger Delgado had that scene in Claws of Axos where he's fooling Benton into giving him the TARDIS. And just sort of turns around and rips the rubber mask off. And his only attempt to disguise his voice is like the difference between my voice now and doing this, Sergeant. I'm in the army.
See, Delgado used to rip off the rubber mask or whatever. In Castrovalva, he just stands up and it flashes between the two characters. And the same thing happens here as well. Mm. Like it just flashes between the two. It's not like he rips off the beard and here he is.
Yeah, yeah.
The rubber mask was never particularly convincing, but it was at least kind of a really visceral way of showing that he had been masked.
Mm-hmm. And he had figured out a way to disguise himself as someone half a foot shorter than himself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, masks can do that, can't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that there's a big problem structurally here too, which is that the Doctor and Sir Gilles are having a fight for no reason. The doctor sort of checks his watch, goes, we're 23 minutes in, I'd better do something dangerous, then just gets up and fights Sir Gilles for no reason at all.
Mm. It is a pretty decent fight, though, and it's well shot. We've got Tony Virgo directing. It's the only time he'll direct Doctor Who. You know, he went on to direct throughout the 80s, lots of high-end stuff for British television at the time. So EastEnders, The Bill, he went on to become a producer, including Peak Practice later on.
Right.
I believe he did come out and work for the ABC for a while as well. We had him for a convention at some point, didn't we, Todd?
Yeah, I'm sure he was there.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's a distant memory.
Sorry if you're listening, Tony. But this was his second show that he'd worked on. He'd done 3 episodes of Angels. And then was asked to do Doctor Who. And he really seems to be going, right, this is my chance to prove myself. Because we get interesting camera angles, great set design, really good lighting as well. And, you know, for the medieval banquet set, they ordered all this practical food so people could actually be eating. And there's the Irish hounds there who...
Oh, there's doggies on set.
They're sort of historically accurate. He got them in for both studio sessions. You know, he's actually really trying hard.
I found myself constantly distracted by that suckling pig, like in shot, it was all I could look at. So I don't know what anyone was saying when that was on screen. And I also think where that sword fight differs from the fantastic sword fight in The Sea Devils is that it's set during a historical period before the invention of the sandwich. And I think that really means that it's slightly inferior.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I like the line, like, you know, best swordman in France. Fortunately, we are in England. I thought that was nice.
Yeah, that's very Errol Flynn.
You're quite right. I mean, why are we having this sword fight? And then it goes, and then just for no reason, the master just stops and reveals himself. Oh my, it's the master.
Mm.
Like, why even reveal yourself? And then Tegan gets to throw a knife at the master in the most pathetic way ever. Like, I really...
He plucks it out of the air. He just grabs it. He catches it.
I just wanted her to get it and go, ah, you know, like real venom. But, oh, yeah.
It's stupid, but it's cool. the knife moment.
I think that is cool.
I really love the Doctor and Tegan relationship in the first episode.
Yeah.
Like, she's so cold out on location. Yeah. They just have this lovely relationship. There's a real warmth to it and it's progressed. It's just so evident.
Yeah, yeah.
It's great.
You do get the impression, and Big Finish have now, I think, slotted some stories in here. You do get the impression that some time has passed since Enlightenment. Tegan is still slightly suspicious of Turlo. Like when he's off by himself, she's kind of constantly saying, "Where's Turlo? What's he up to?" But I, she has accepted what has happened previously. Although we did end the last story, didn't we?
Yeah.
I think Todd pointed this out between recordings that Turlo's like, "Let's go back to my home planet." And at the beginning of the story, and at the end of the story, we were meant to be going to my home planet.
Yeah, like, so maybe no stories can fit in here.
Yeah, yeah.
Bad luck, Big Finish.
No picking up Nyssa on this podcast watch.
I've been complaining all season about lack of character deaths, right? But we do get one here in episode
Sir
2.
Jeffrey.
And it's actually I'm very affected by it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The master doesn't pull the trigger, but he gets somebody else to shoot him in the back with the arrow.
And he's kind of good looking and he's a good guy and he's got a relationship with, you know, our two main characters and they react to his death. It is actually a death that kind of lands.
I think. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And it's not resolved. It's not like the killer's brought to justice. We never see the crossbower, whoever it was, did the master hypnotize him. We don't know. But he never seems to be caught. Turlo just cops the blame for it and they run off at the end. A lot of people in terms of the Fifth Doctor and Tegan have pointed to that scene where Tegan says, "Look at that huge bed." And the Doctor's like, "Another way of keeping warm." Oh, really? How did that slip under the radar?
It's not that huge either, really, is it?
No,
it's like
no.
A single.
Yeah, well, it's huge, you know, it's huge for the BBC. But there was an interesting aside in the production subtitles. The production subtitles don't raise the double entendre. They just mention chairs were only for luxury and nobility at this time. So it would be quite understandable for beds to be so big because it would be the only piece of furniture to sit on in most rooms, in most bedrooms. But you will notice that this room has 2 chairs.
Ooh.
And the Doctor and Tegan don't sit in either of them. They don't sit at all. They just wander around going, I'm cold too. Here's a blanket. Oh, thank you, I'm cold.
But somebody does sit in it, and that's the king, who's not really the king, but the newest member of the TARDIS crew, Chameleon.
This would have been just an utterly terrible idea, as it actually proved to be. I think the Chameleon prop looks terrible, and I think it's actually not very well directed, particularly in that scene where he's being welcomed on board the TARDIS, where he's shot in such a way that you can't actually see his eyes.
Yep.
He's delivering dialogue, but his eyes aren't visible because he's looking away. I think there's a huge problem with the prop. I think it looks off-putting. I think the mouth movements are horrific.
Yeah.
It shares with K-9 a really loud motor. You can actually hear it moving. The neck, the crinkly neck is awful. It's an ugly prop, and it would have been a terrible idea to actually have it again. And just as they've got the TARDIS crew to be two people who are reasonably interesting and identifiable, you're going to put a space robot from the planet Zarephas in the show? Like, why do that? What's wrong with you?
What was Jonathan Turner thinking?
Yeah.
Like, they went and saw this thing in action, and it really even wasn't working properly quite then, but lots of promises. And it's just appalling. Like, we don't see it now after this until its final story. And it's like, if you're going to introduce it, you'd think you'd be using it in every story in some aspect. That's my opinion, if you're going to be part of the crew. Like, in The Five Doctors, why can't you set it up to be a fake doctor, for example? Or in The Awakening that's coming up, the Malice is taking over things. Why can't it take over Chameleon and have it turn into some sort of person that walks out of the TARDIS? You know, there's just nothing.
You do know there's a big production reason why this happens. So they had wanted to have a scene with Chameleon in The Awakening, voiced by Mark Strickson, but it was cut for time.
Yeah, it was filmed. It is on the DVD.
Right.
Yeah.
But they had problems getting the prop to work. Am I wrong about this? Because the guy who was originally meant to program it died tragically in a car accident, and so they couldn't get it to work properly or quickly.
I know that he died, all right, and the hardware guy was still around. And if you watch the documentary, I think it's on Planet of the Fire, he actually is like, oh, you know, we did such a great job with it, and, you know, he's so proud of what they managed to do. And everybody else he's interviewed says that it's the biggest load of crap ever.
Yeah.
But even so, even in like Planet of Fire, I know I'm jumping ahead, but even if you had him just standing there and then, you know, somebody, the transition into a real person, do you know what I mean? And then using it that way and not really seeing the robot.
But I would hate there to be a shape-shifting character in the TARDIS. I just hate. It's so stupid and so science fiction-y an idea. Yeah.
It's a bit like early Deep Space Nine. It took them a while to figure out what to do with Odo, who ended up being a magnificent character. But very early on, he's just there occasionally to shimmer into a pile of goo or to turn into something to be smuggled on board a ship. You know, for the first season, Odo's a MacGuffin. But then they figure out his backstory and his relationship with Kira. And he's probably my favourite character on that series.
Great performance too.
Yeah, René Auberjonois. In terms of Chameleon, I've tried to research what happened exactly to the programmer, because at first I heard he died in a car accident just before The King's Demons, but the guy who built the model, who's still with us and still owns Chameleon, says he died shortly after Planet of Fire in a sailing accident. So I don't know. You know, he was his mate, so I'd probably side with him. But the thing that just baffles me about Chameleon is, why not just have an actor? He's a shape-shifting robot. You know, the prop can appear for 5 minutes at the beginning of episode one, for which you need 4 weeks programming time, and then he can turn into Christopher Brown. Get him to look into Tegan's mind and pull out the image of Mariner, because, oh, wouldn't Christopher Brown and Mariner have made a good companion?
Yeah.
And Chameleon can have the whole thing about discovering humanity and discovering emotion, because you do get glimpses of Chameleon's character here, and he's arrogant. You know, and who knows where it shall end. I'm in the TARDIS now, ahaha. Yeah, there's a bit of character there in the last 5 minutes.
Is that the ending line, who knows where it shall end?
No, the ending line is the Doctor saying, we're going there already.
Oh, the Eye of Orion.
The Eye of Orion.
That's a very strange bit too, where he's mean to Tegan sort of suddenly and threatens to put her off the ship, like at the beginning of the Reign of Terror.
Well, Tegan bitch scene.
I think there is a bit of cleverness there, because, of course, you know, we've noted that and that Nyssa was the peacekeeper, and now Nyssa's been gone for two stories. And, you know, back in season 19, Tegan was pushing the Doctor around and saying, you got to get me home, and the broken clock keeps better time and diet. So I think at this point, the Doctor's just going, right, okay, you want to have a temper tantrum? Fine, I'm putting you off. And immediately Tegan's like, well, I don't want to leave. And the Doctor goes, oh, okay, then. I think that's actually a subtle reversal of, yeah, we did last season kind of say, why do Tegan and the Doctor keep hanging out together?
Yeah.
But here we kind of get the answer to that, because they've got each other's measure now. They know how to push each other's buttons, and they also know how to react.
Yeah.
And it's nowhere near as bad as the next female companion will be treated in the TARDIS, because you never seriously believe that the Doctor's doing a Billy and saying, right, next stop, off the ship, Chesaman. You know that the Doctor is winding Tegan up, yeah, just the way that Tegan winds the Doctor up. It's quite a cute moment, but Richard did point out during the week that Pete at the end going, oh no, that's where we're going anyway. It's a Scooby-Doo ending. You know, yeah. Thankfully we cut before Mark Strickson goes, oh,
you know, they should have cut to Chameleon laughing. That would have been lovely. I was annoyed at the time that Chameleon spends like a year in a cupboard. Like, it just annoyed me that he was never mentioned or brought up again.
Mm. What happens to him in Frontios? Is he the hat stand? Does he transmogrify? Yeah,
he probably does.
In reality, it's thank goodness, really.
Yeah, well, that's right. I can't think of a bad Doctor Who story that couldn't be made much, much worse by the addition of Chameleon.
Do you know that when I originally saw this as a kid, because we got the stories like one episode a night, five nights a week, I actually wanted Chameleon. You know, when it turns into Tegan, I thought they might turn it into Nyssa, who I was really mourning. And I really wanted it to be Nyssa, like to have a little cameo like what Adric had. He turns her into Tegan, and doesn't they walk into the TARDIS? And
Yeah.
Doesn't he say something to Turlo, like, yes, I'm afraid so, or something?
It's really funny too, because doesn't Tegan say, can anyone else see this, or something? Like, there's another me in here.
And Turlo says something like, yes, unfortunately. I will say, as a kid, because this is another one I came to during the 1990s repeat season, so around 11 or 12. As a kid, Chameleon's a great idea. I loved Chameleon as a kid, and there was a BBC book, The Ultimate Treasure, by Christopher Bulis, which uses Chameleon in a very interesting way. And I won't spoil anything else because he comes up in there, but you kind of read that and go, actually, the TV show could have done this.
Right.
In the end, he just represents not seeing the forest for the trees. They kind of go, hey, we can have this robot, and hey, he can be a shapeshifter, and they get hung up on the robot bit. It's like, I agree with you, Nathan, shapeshifting characters can be an easy out. Like, sometimes they used well, like Space 1999 Season 2, not that it's a great TV show anyway, but the conceit that Maya can turn into an animal opens the plot up.
Or the conceit that she can turn into a guy in a kind of shaggy nylon suit at will.
Yeah.
See, I think that's always awful. You know, the scene where Maya realizes that turning into an eagle or something will solve our problems is just sort of cringeworthy and embarrassing. And to have that all the time in Doctor Who, that Doctor Who is now a program about, you know, the Doctor and some friends and a crazy shape-shifting robot. That's awful. And particularly when the robot is so, so off-putting. Mm. I mean, K-9, you know, is a box, you know, joined to another box with a tube. And he's so lovable and relatable, you know, and he wags his tail and all of that. And he's got a couple of great actors doing the performance. You know, this is awful.
Yeah, I think the only way Chameleon's shape-shifting abilities could have worked, and as I mentioned earlier, we get a glimpse of his character, and he's like glib and, you know, what have you. I think it really would have worked if he'd chosen a human form, and then when, you know, people say to him, but why don't you change what? Well, why should I? I'm perfectly happy as I am. Why should I change for you? Basically, he should have been Quentin Crisp in space.
I'm kind of thinking that maybe he is in all of the subsequent stories. And so
Turlo's having a nap during this one.
Yeah. Why not? Or like, he's Chancellor Flavia this week, or he's Skibus, you know, next week and stuff like that. Yeah. Why couldn't that be happening?
Yeah, during the awakening, Turlo's like, I'm not visiting Tegan's bloody granddad. Chameleon, you go do it. Oh,
and maybe the Doctor does that sometimes too.
He could be the Murker.
He was the Murker all the time.
Look, it's just... Oh, dear.
Oh, God. Okay, so next season, the drinking game, dear listeners, is Chameleon Watch.
Yeah. Yeah, who is Chameleon in this story? I think we make it a regular thing.
Just, look, it's just so ill-conceived. And, you know, he could have been... Yeah, come aboard the TARDIS, we'll take you home and... Take him home and never mention him again.
Or even if he then turns up in Planet of Fire, just have the Doctor say, oh, yeah, we put him in a cupboard and forgot to take him home.
That's right. We didn't have a USB-C port, so he ran out of batteries.
I did that with two teachers ages ago. Just kept forgetting to take him home. Had it written down in felt tip and everything. Fast return.
And the Doctor... Oh, anyhow, back to this scintillating story.
Story, in inverted commas.
The Doctor leaves a nasty surprise for the Master at the end of this story, doesn't he, with the tissue compression eliminator set to something so that it will cause problems with the Master's TARDIS. Is that right?
Yeah. Is it what shrinks him for Planet of Fire? Is that why he ends up in a little box?
No. Because we've got the five Doctors.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Maybe he goes back in time or something. So nothing happens to the Master then. Because he's in the five Doctors. He's just fine.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The last time we see the Master, he's just shouting at the TARDIS fading away, medieval misfit.
That's a great bit of dialogue, isn't it?
Yeah. But I have read a fan theory. I'll probably bring this up again when we get to Planet of Fire. That for the Master, the five Doctors takes place after Planet of Fire and the Time Lords pick him out of the flames.
Oh, okay. I'm going with that. Yeah, I'm headcanoning that.
Okay.
Right.
Shall we say something about the actual script for this story? Because we've given Terence Dudley a hard time for Canine and Company and Black Orchid, but the script works.
It's a really boring premise, though. I think it's been observed over and over again that Magna Carta doesn't actually have the big historic impact that this story claims it has. Mm. There's something kind of colonialist about, you know, disrupting England is going to be a huge sort of disaster for the human race.
Yeah.
And even the story lampshades it by saying it's small-time villainy, even for his standards. It's boring. Mm. And why does the Doctor turn up there? Is it just a coincidence?
Why is the Master in disguise before the Doctor turns up?
Well, he just dresses up to relax, though, doesn't he? I mean, that's what the whole Khalid outfit was all about, too.
Oh, dear.
Kind of want to see Missy in, like, a Carmen Miranda fruit hat, and the Doctor turns up and says, oh, not one of your cunning disguises. No, dear, I didn't know you were coming. This is just Thursday.
Something I threw on.
There's other things that, like, I don't find the horse jousting thing, I never find that exciting myself. I kind of go, oh, whatever. And I really hate court jesters. I just want to just punch him in the face, you know?
It's not even Terry Walsh. I will say, like, the location shooting, they only got about half the shots they wanted. That all the shots they missed, they did then plan to do in the studio. It wasn't a matter of running out of time. It was just that the weather was so horrible.
Yeah, you can tell.
So the jousting was meant to run the same amount of time but have twice the amount of shots. It was meant to be fast-paced and action-y, and you're meant to see Chris Villiers' stunt double fall off his horse and do a tumble and what have you. And just because of the weather, they couldn't do the stunts.
I'm okay with that. Like, I'm okay that it's as short as it is because it does nothing for me and it wouldn't do anything more. I think my biggest disappointment with this is the fact that there's just not enough doors.
Yeah. Where were the doors?
There's the door. Well, I don't know. There's a door going into the King's Chamber and I don't know.
Dudley's grown as a writer. He feels that he's mined the people going through doors trope really enough and he'd like to move on and try more exciting things like closing people in Iron Maidens.
Yes.
Well, I suppose that's a door. Yeah. Although the Iron Maiden, as we understand it and as we see it in the story, is, I believe, a Victorian invention or 17th or 18th century. Or 18th or 19th, I should say.
Is it something the Victorians said that people did in the Middle Ages, but it never really actually happened?
No. Yeah. I mean, I think where the confusion comes from were they were kind of... cylinders where people would be incarcerated, but they weren't spiked or anything like that.
I love the mentions of boiling in oil. I think that's always delightful for a sort of family entertainment program.
And again, the production subtitles on the DVD are a wealth because they detail the three methods of boiling in oil that people would use.
Delightful. I love the way that when it's announced that the Doctor and Turlough are to be boiled in oil, Turlough looks at the Doctor. He's really cross.
Again.
See what you did?
This is why I wanted to go home and we're here.
So this wasn't supposed to be the final story of the season. Was supposed to cliffhanger into a Dalek story. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. And the cliffhanger will survive, and we'll see that at the end of Frontios, where they get caught in the Daleks' time tunnel. And so that story was going to be called The Return. It is made next year with very minor changes as Resurrection of the Daleks.
So it was going to be called The Return, presumably so they could do an Earth Shock again.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't call it
a surprise.
Yeah.
And then they decided not to do that. But it was just going to be called The Return. But the other part of The Return was going to be the Daleks getting Davros back. And in the original production, it was to be directed by Peter Grimwade.
Uh-huh.
And Michael Wisher was to be back as Davros.
Wow.
But he then couldn't make the dates the following year. But he had agreed to come back. And this actually led to Peter Grimwade not directing for the program again.
Because it fell through because of all the strikes and having to reschedule Enlightenment and into these slots and sort of thing.
That's part of it. But what also happened was, of course, everyone was very disappointed to lose the story. So Peter Grimwade decided he would take Eric Saywood and the cast out to lunch one day, and he'd take JNT out to lunch the next day. And he booked two lunches. But JNT heard about the first lunch first.
And had a giant hissy fit.
And kind of went, why am I not invited? First of all, when Peter Grimwade turned up to take Eric Saywood out to lunch, that was a surprise.
Yeah.
And it was going to be a surprise for John. And John came into Eric's office and, oh, where's Eric? Oh, he's gone out to lunch with Peter Grimwade. What? But that's why he still writes for the show, because he still had a good relationship with Eric Saywood. Well, this story really suffers because, as I say, you know, the script, it's like, yes, it's boring and Magna Carta's not that it becomes important for other things. Magna Carta leads to other things,
yeah.
But in itself, it's not that important. And it doesn't help that the Doctor at no point explains why we should care about Magna Carta. Like, he says to Tegan at one point, don't you know your history? And she says, yes, I know my history, and that's it. What it really feels like, though, this feels like part one and two of a three-part story. It feels like the Master should now go to London and do something with the real King and pose a bigger threat. Because, you know, even without the android, the Master's resourceful. He should still be able to do something. He should disguise himself as the King.
Yeah, he's good at that.
But that's the thing. It feels like there's more of this story to be told, or there should be anyway. But, yeah, compared to Terence Dudley's other contributions, this is bloody City of Death.
I do think it also suffers from not leading into the Dalek story. So it's just this sort of rather limp ending to the season.
Yeah, I always think of Enlightenment as the end of the season, and then I suddenly go, oh, yeah, this exists.
Yeah.
So I haven't done a ratings update forever.
So, yeah, how did the back end of the season perform?
So 5.8 million viewers tuned into episode one, 107th on the chart. So I think this is the worst placed and rated episode of the season. And then episode two was 6.6.
Okay.
You know, this season, as I mentioned before, the average is just over 7 million. 66th is a good chart position for this year. I think there's only three episodes inside the top 70 and most of the rest are between 70 and 100. So the show, as I mentioned, has slid down, you know, a good 30, 40 places down the charts. And we've lost a couple of million viewers all season. Most of the episodes are between about 6.5 and 7.5 million. We're on air less. Like last year, they were on air for 13 weeks. This year, 11 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, losing 2 million viewers, there has to be something.
I think there's someone once said, I can't remember whether it was friend of the podcast, Peter Griffiths or not, that Doctor Who used to be on kind of all the time, and then it turns into something that's on for a couple of months a year.
Mm.
And when it's on all the time, or, you know, even half the year, it's something that people are going to watch.
Yeah.
I know that the Saturday night thing wasn't working out for it necessarily, but now that it's just one of the many things that's on during the week, is that the reason?
Well, it could well be because it's, you know, it's shunted around the Monday to Friday slot over the three Peter Davison years. Yeah. It's not consistent.
All right.
John Nathan Turner did actually try to get it moved back to Saturday nights for this season and Saturday nights and once a week, because his idea was started a bit later in the year,
yeah,
and have it run through till November to have five Doctors screen
right
at the end of the season.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you know, obviously with the return being scuppered, that wouldn't have worked anyway.
Yeah.
But it seems a bit odd to me that his first season on Saturday nights performed so poorly. His second season, weeknights, performed much better, literally double the ratings in some cases. It seems an odd choice for him to make. But at the same time, the BBC had been getting letters saying, look, Doctor Who has moved from 5:30 or 6 o'clock on a Saturday night to 7:30 Monday and Tuesday. My children are usually in bed by then, but they want to stay up and watch Doctor Who, and then they're excited about it and they don't get to bed for another hour. So I think actually maybe he was being sensitive to that viewer thing. I know it sounds funny, but if you look at interviews Peter Davison gives on like BBC Breakfast or News at One and that kind of thing, quite often they will talk to him about the scheduling. And there's an interview, I think it's on Nationwide, for the Five Doctors, and you've got Peter, Pat and John, and Pat says something along the lines of, oh, you know, we were on all year, not like this guy. And the host actually says, well, yes, it's tears before bedtime for me because I won't let them stay up and watch it. Yeah. So you got to wonder if that has an effect on the ratings.
Mm.
I think also at this time, the BBC was having money taken out of it. And also our departments started to be farmed out because, remember, by the end of the decade, Doctor Who's the only drama they're making in-house.
Yeah.
So the drama departments at the BBC are becoming less and less and less. You've got more American imports over on ITV, so I think that affects it. I think, yeah, the presence of it. If they had have maybe kept it weeknights but done one a week,
yeah,
it feels bigger.
It's in people's minds.
Yes.
For longer.
Yeah.
I mean, that might be a reflection too on the amount of publicity that JNT does and all the little hooks he does to try and get publicity.
Maybe last year was a spike caused by Pete's casting.
Well, he certainly had a presence, so he would have brought over fans from All Creatures Great and Small.
Yeah, and the other things he was in.
That's right. So, you know, they've come in to sample it. But, you know, even if you take that 2 million off, if you compare like the 7 million this year to the 5 million for Tom's last season, there's still a differential there.
Yeah.
So
it's not quite circling the drain yet.
No. But, you know, the less it's on, the less it's in people's minds, the less there's that renewal of the younger audience.
Mm. And yeah, it's never going to be on, even today, it's never going to be on now for more than 14 weeks of the year.
Yeah.
So it's time for our Jenny Laird Awards for Most Puzzling Creative Choice. And for me, it's a pretty easy one this time. My puzzling creative choice goes to John Nathan Turner for cutting the extra hour out of the Terminus recording. You know, you've got the director offside, you've got the cast offside, because something you always say, Todd, about when cast members are leaving and they bring their A game, you know, Sarah Sutton knows she's leaving, and then all of a sudden she knows she has to come back in 6 weeks to record more scenes. And she's, you know, I look at those scenes and I can't tell that it's 2 months later for her. She's a very good actress. I'm not criticizing her. But it's a matter of there doesn't seem to have been any explanation forthcoming as to why the extra hour was yanked away so late. You know, if John Nathan Turner had said to Mary Ridge 2 days before, look, I'm really sorry, I cannot get that extra hour for you, let's sit down with the shooting script and see what we can figure out, that would have been fine, and that is a part of the job that the directors have to deal with. But she'd already lost 2 days of shooting. Something I didn't mention last week, the Kari and Olvir costumes had to be remade because they were in blue. Even though they were in no blue screen scenes, Mary Ridge didn't want to get into the position where all of a sudden, oh, crap,
I can't blue screen.
And so the costumes had to be entirely remade in white, you know, and Mary Ridge had said no blue.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of sounds like the Julia Smith on the Underwater Menace situation, in that no one was helping her on her first time around to make the show she wanted to make. Because we see in Blake 7 Series 4, she's an incredibly talented director. She cares about making the show look good. And as she put it, part of the reason she never worked on the show again, she was so outraged because she never finishes late. That was her thing. She does complex things and she gets them done on time, but she was just treated completely unfairly. And I'm not someone to bash John Nathan Turner. I'm not even really someone to bash Eric Saywood. I'll criticize him. But I'm also able to acknowledge when he does things well. But John Nathan Turner, what the hell were you thinking cutting an hour out of a show that had already lost 2 days?
I want to bash Eric Saywood, actually.
I thought you might.
Yeah. We've already spoken a lot about the decision to make Chameleon a regular, so I'm going to disallow that for my Journey to Bed nomination this time, although I think it's perhaps the worst creative decision of the entire... Oh, no. That is my choice. I can't think of anything worse. I mean, this is a season that had Arc of Infinity with all of its puzzling creative choices, including bringing Omega back as some guy who's called Omega but seems to bear no relationship with our Omega who we loved all these years. That was puzzling, and we talked about it quite a lot on our Arc of Infinity episode, but that can be my second ranking one. I don't think it can possibly eclipse whoever's decision, J&T's decision, presumably, to bring Chameleon on board as a full-time companion. Terrible idea.
Right. Well, I've got a number of nominations for my Jenny Laird, and one of my nominations is the Chameleon. Another nomination, I think it's for Eric Saywood, looking at these scripts and just having these corridors and no deaths, and it's just a creative puzzling choice to me that we didn't break it up with something that wasn't that, yeah, and that was doing my head in for, yeah, four stories. And I think that's a really big one for me. What was my other one? Oh, the casting of the Lord President in Arc of Infinity is one of the worst decisions in the history of the show. And really, that is like, I think I'm just going to have to put that in. As much as I don't like that other, I hate him so much, so much. I don't even care what his name was.
Leonard Sachs, dear listener.
Well, he should have been sacked as far as I'm concerned. The creative puzzling choice is also from Jonathan Turner, or grasping onto this thing about the publicity for the season, about all these returning 20th anniversary, you know, concepts. Like, they're just, just nothingness there, really. Like, it's just a big fizzle.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things here that I can nominate for this season, but I think Leonard Sachs is it.
You see, I feel the same way. I feel there's so many things in this season that go wrong, but at the same time, I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. But I have to agree with you there, Todd. I think a big problem is when they got up and said, we're having something returning in every story. It's like, if they hadn't have said that, the anticipation wouldn't have been there, and the whole season would have been more favourably received. Matt Smith runs into the same problem with Series 6, where Stephen Moffat built up all this anticipation. Oh, everything changes this season. You will notice that Season 7, Season 8, Season 9, the upcoming Season 10, Stephen Moffat says very little about what to expect now, because this isn't necessarily the producers being disingenuous, but any kind of show, the more you big it up, the more people will be disappointed, because your words telling us how amazing it's going to be are going to be interpreted differently by different people. If you come to this season, as I originally did, not being aware that it's meant to be this big celebratory season, you get some thoughtful sci-fi stories, most of which don't really hang together.
So this is only kind of like a backported intention. Like, they didn't set out to have something recurring. Yeah.
It's, I think, just, that's the other part of the problem.
Well, because, I mean, in season 21, there are a number of returning elements as well.
Yeah.
And it does become something the show does until Cartmell takes over and puts a stop to it with Paradise Towers. So it probably would have happened anyway. This was just a publicity thing.
Yeah, yeah. But I think the problem isn't bringing stuff back. It's the problem is putting up a big billboard saying, we're bringing stuff back.
Yeah, I think bringing stuff back is a problem.
Okay, picks of the week. I actually have a Twitter account I think everyone should follow.
Ooh.
It's called @WhoLabels. And it's a Twitter account posting pictures of the various labels and signs that appear in Doctor Who. I don't think they've done vacuum shield off yet, but they have specifically said in sort of their raison d'etre, they're avoiding all the big signs for now. So they're putting up little signs and seeing if people get them, like Bessie's anti-theft device. And the fast return switch. It's just this joyful Twitter account. So that is @WhoLabels.
All right, I'm following them now.
Todd?
My pick of the week is not Doctor Who. It's an album by the band Wang Chung, who were very big in the 1980s, having such hits as Dance Hall Days, Let's Go, and probably the most famous one, Everybody Have Fun Tonight.
Oh.
Off their third album, Warmer Side of Cool, there are two tracks. The first one is called Praying to a New God, which I think relates rather nicely to Snake Dance. And the third track is called Snake Dance.
Oh, wow.
But it relates to a different sort of snake dancing, and I'll just leave it at that. And that's my pick of the week. Go and check it out on iTunes.
Cool. Mine isn't sort of particularly sort of relevant or contemporary, but over the last school holiday when I was on the plane, I read The Writer's Tale again by Russell Davies and Benjamin Cook. And I love the Russell T Davies era of Doctor Who. I really do. He's my, obviously, you know, my favourite of the two producers. And those first four seasons of Doctor Who I think are terrific. They're really great. And I also sort of feel that we got to know the production because we had Confidential and we had them all on commentaries and, you know, we knew David and Julie and Catherine and all of those people. And so there's something really nice about reminiscing about that era. And this is a email correspondence between Doctor Who Magazine's Benjamin Cook and Russell T Davies about basically the production of season four and the specials. And it's illustrated with cartoons by Russell T Davies, who ends up being a really talented cartoonist. And he draws cartoons of the characters and scenes that he imagines and things. And he also talks about what writing is like, and he reflects on his previous shows and stuff. It's really, really good.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing. And I know there are a few of our listeners who are not huge new series fans. I would also recommend this book to them because, as you say, Russell goes into quite a bit of detail and quite a bit of self-analysis as to the positives and the negatives of the new series, and in particular his analysis of The Next Doctor and the solution at the end of The Next Doctor and how he would have done it differently and why he kind of says, why did I not think of this new plot ending before? It's so obvious, and I've made a terrible mistake. He's an incredibly humble writer from these emails. It is an amazing book. And I would also say to anyone who enjoys the book, you can follow Benjamin Cook on Twitter at Benjamin_Cook. And he's very entertaining on Twitter as well. Right, well, that's all the time we have for Season 20 and for The King's Demons, unless that missing third episode turns up. Do come back next week. However, we are back with a commentary on The Five Doctors. And that is for all four of us. Anything can happen in those 90 minutes. Until then, you can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, we're continuing through the Roger Moore era with Moonraker on bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter. And I have the complete 60s rundown, seasons 1 to 6, done on Doctor Who in 10 Seconds over on YouTube, so check that out as well. Until next time, may no one mind control your robots and turn them into Janet Fielding. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Au revoir.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bealby, Nathan Bottomley, and Brendan Jones. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Fairly Obvious, was recorded on the 31st of July 2016. Next episode will be released on October 15th. Fans of ill-conceived shapeshifters can enjoy the series Manimal from 1983, now available on DVD. For some reason. Do you need a cough?
No, but I'm having weird breathing issues.
Oh, okay.
And it's all right. I should still live to the end of the recording session.